Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. You know, I've been trying to speak to my guest, Rabi Alameddine, for around 6 years since I read his vast and wonderful novel, The Hakawadi. Then I read An Unnecessary Woman, which just won the Prix Feminina. He's just returned from Paris, where he won this award. And now he's written a book called The Angel of History. In this book, the protagonist is soul dead. He's been living for years with the deaths of his friends due to the AIDS crisis. And there are no longer people who remember how funny the friends were, how sexy the sex was, how incredible it was to build a community that was literally pulled apart. The narrator, one might call it, of the book is a man who was a poet. He was born in Yemen. He lived in America. His mother was a prostitute. She was in an Egyptian whorehouse.
Brothel. Not to put... Whorehouse is the right word.
Well, someone said brothel, and I said, that's not right. Rabi says whorehouse. Let's say whorehouse. Let's not leave these things to chance. And what is interesting is that the book is simultaneously a sublime book and a dirty book. It mixes the facts of life with the soul searching for the angelic. Therefore, the angelic, the angel of history. Now, the angel of history is the name of an essay by Walter Benjamin. And I noticed that in your last book, the main character lights candles for Walter Benjamin. Why Walter Benjamin and why the Angel of History?
Well, a number of reasons. The narrator of the previous book lights candles for Walter Benjamin because he's a wonderful writer, and she admired wonderful writers, but she was also a translator, and he has written an incredible essay on translation. And what it actually takes to translate. In this book, it is based primarily on that essay, which is a short piece, The Angel of History, about a painting of the same name by Paul Klee. And it's about how one looks back. And the Angel of History has his back turned and is looking at the past and to see the destruction all of the forces moving forward has caused, and he wants time to grieve. And that passage is tremendously moving. So obviously it had to be the title of the book, because that's what Jacob Ya'ub is working on.
He's working on grief and trying to make a decision. His soul is being fought over by Satan, who is also known by his Muslim name in this book, which is
Iblis.
And they're rather different figures. One of the things the book asks us to do is to imagine that the difference between cultures creates differences of experience, understanding, change. In the book, characters think of the Middle East as one place. They don't know the difference between Lebanon and Egypt. They just say Middle East, and there it is. And the Angel of History wants to make distinctions and believes that distinctions are important. This soul is being battled for by the devil, who wants to bring him back to life and mischief, and death, who wants him to sip the waters of the famous river in hell, the Lethe, which are the waters of forgetfulness.
Right now, we live in an age of forgetfulness. We live in a culture, whether it's the government or the media or everything, that basically asks us to keep forgetting constantly and moving forward. What Satan in this book is doing, and what I try to do, is to ask at what cost. And it's not that we have to remember everything, because then we'll be, you know, doing nothing, really, if all we have are these memories. But it is important to see the tension between the two, or as Satan in the book calls it, the dance between him and death, that they've been dancing constantly.
The central character, Jacob, of my guest Rabbi Alameddine's book, The Angel of History, is someone who has watched most of his friends die in the AIDS epidemic. It is 30 years later. He is still talking to his lover, who he refers to as Doc. Memory is what's left of these friends, six of them. They died during a period of 6 months. This is a passage called Restless Heart.
The beating of your heart kept me awake one night. For months after you died, I saw you everywhere, heard your voice, sonorous, throaty, reverberating in my ear. I wasn't crazy. I knew you were dead. I buried you after all. I mean, I burned you, cremated you. But I kept seeing you, doing dishes in the kitchen with your back to me. I'd call you as you stacked each plate in our plastic dish rack, but you didn't look back, and then you were gone in a flash, and I was left with nothing, not even an after image. I didn't mistake you for anybody. I never saw you in a crowd, thinking someone else was you. No, it was never like that. I saw you in the hallway, in our hallway, under the Turkish lamp you brought back from Istanbul when you were there so long ago. Remember the trouble they gave you at customs for a $20 lamp? And when you emerged from the swinging doors, you were furious. I kept telling you to calm down, but you wouldn't. You went on and on because you were angry, and you were an American, and you could ruffle feathers at airports. While I was alive, I loved you while you were alive, and I loved you still, but I forgot for a while. Forgive me. I couldn't obsess about you all the time, so you disappeared as if I'd bleached my memory. But you came back, you know, like a fungal infection. Remember Thrush, the white stains that attacked your innocent tongue, looked like snowy down on old strawberries. We couldn't get rid of it, and you hated it, and I hated it, and you wanted it over. When, to make you feel better, I joked that the furry fungus matched your white lab coat, you turned apoplectic, wanted to strangle me. I still regret that. I thought it was funny at the time. You'd been gone for decades. You hid deep in my lakes. Why now? Why infect my dreams now? What flood is this? Once, as I was buying groceries in a store where a young third worlder mopped the floor back and forth, around a yellow sign that announced piso mojado, the mephitic aroma of disinfected assaulted my senses, and you jumped the levee of my memory. Proust had his Madeleine, but bleach was all ours, Doc, all ours. The tomatoes didn't look too good, and I just went home. I'd been a coward. I was scared. Do notice I said scared and not frightened. You taught me the difference. You said, children get scared. Men might feel afraid, might even feel terror, but men don't get scared. I'd been so lonely since you died. You left me roofless in a downpour. You gripped the bed rail when you took your final breath, and I had to pry open your fingers one by one to free you. It took 17 minutes because my hands were shaking so much. Even in death, you were stronger than I and more obstinate. The mortician told me it took forever to burn you. Thrice he had to put you in the incinerator. you refuse to turn to ash. You sincerely believed that the distance between you and me would one day disappear. You told me I was not my mother and you were not my father. But how could we not be? How could we not be? The stones over her cenotaph still felt so very heavy. You held out your arms and said, "Join me," but I couldn't. And you said, "Let me love you," and I couldn't because you wanted to be so close. You held out the fireman's net and said, "Jump," and I couldn't. I felt the fall was much too great. I chose to go back into the fire. You said, "I like it when you doze on my chest," but I said, "The hair on your chest irritates my cheeks and makes it difficult to sleep." I could hardly bear the beauty of you. You were gone for so long, and I moved along, and everyone told me I was alive, but that night, in my bed, each time my ear touched the single pillow, I heard your heartbeat once more, once more, once more, once more. My heart is restless until it rests in thee.
Rabia Al-Ahmadine, reading a section from his novel, The Angel of History. Now imagine, listener, you will have in your hands a book in which the devil is speaking to death. There's a cadre taking part in those interviews between death and the devil. All of the saints that Jacob was taught to call on when he was young appear, beginning with Saint Catherine. Some of the saints have been decapitated, and they carry their their heads under their arms. It's hilarious. I mean, this is a hilarious book, and it is also a serious book, an allegorical book, just as it is a dirty book and a sublime book. What brought the saints marching in?
Oh, well, what's life without saints? I mean, a lot of it has to do with these 14 saints were brought together. I call it sort of a sale, an occasion, because during the plague years, during the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, people would get sick so quickly and die that they would not get absolution, and they didn't have time to pray for different saints for different things. So they collected these 14 saints that they could pray at one time for. So I love this idea of, you know, having a collective of saints. And what was interesting was that they were primarily Middle Eastern and Mediterranean saints. So, of course, when I was writing about the AIDS year, the whole idea of bringing back these saints for the AIDS years was important. But it was also interesting because most of the saints were sort of decanonized by the Pope in 1969, who said that their stories were apocryphal, that they didn't really exist. And I found that interesting, that it was all the Middle Eastern saints that their stories were not true, whereas, you know, all the Italian saints were kept.
Yes, there are what I would like to call diabolical stories by Jacob himself. One is of drone bombers who are delighted by their handiwork, and I found their comments to one another. They're drawn, in a sense, from that line, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning," from Apocalypse Now. But these are people who are thrilled by the destruction that they can wield on families who are doing nothing more than traveling to a wedding. And the other one I remember is a party at which the very wealthy, the owner of the company and his boyfriend, they
have a party, and they invite this couple who work for them and who had just moved from Muncie, Indiana. And they want to make an impression, the people from Muncie, and the couple have a party entertainment, or so to speak. They have a pet, an Arab in a cage. And the reason they have, and when they are asked why do they have an Arab in a cage, and one of the owners says because he's allergic to cats.
It's a horrifying and often very funny passage. I would say more horrifying than funny.
Yeah, it's supposed to be horrifying. It's how, at least in this book, it is written as to how Jacob sees that he is being treated.
Yes, and that he is able to render this and render it satirically. It's his way of escaping from self-pity mm-hmm. by becoming ferociously satirical. And I wanted to ask you about that, because this book seems as if it would have been monstrously difficult to write, in particular to avoid the thorn bushes of self-pity.
Well, it was very difficult to write, emotionally speaking. I always joke that I started seeing my psychoanalyst 4 times a week when I was writing this book. And I needed it. I needed it for many things. The thing with the satirical stories in particular is that they were able to relieve some of the sort of self-pity and the whining. I mean, he is grieving and moaning his losses. And had I not put some sort of satire or if you want to just pure out humor, it would have been too much. It becomes like one long whine. So it's the balance of that one has to do with to make it to approachable and not make it that difficult. You know, like how does he survive if he has that kind of grief? Well, he survives by being self-deprecating and funny.
And he is fantastically obedient and subservient. He manages in the course of his love affair to endure an open relationship which he does not like. He feels that when his lover brings home a beautiful young boy, that the young boy is also being astonishingly rude mm-hmm. for coming into the house. There's the sense, really, that Doc, the lover, would not be loved by someone less forgiving than Jacob.
Yes. And that was a big part of it. I mean, a lot of it has to do with, it is extremely difficult to explain to many Westerners what it's like to grow up in a country that was once a colony. The amount of shame that one feels, it really, only gay men who grew up in a very religious or straight household would understand that for those of us who grew up in a colonized country like Lebanon, everything Western was superior to ours. Everything blonde was superior to us. And we aspired to a certain level of not us. So that Jacob, for me, became sort of the epitome of that, where he is in many ways so brilliant, but he thinks so little of himself. And it becomes sort of a look at most of us, at how Arab Americans are viewed and how Arab Americans behave. A lot of it has to do with the constant shame and constantly being shamed that we are what we are.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Rabia Lamadeen about his book, The Angel of History. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking to a writer I've been yearning to talk to for years now. I think he's one of the major writers writing not just in America, but he's writing about Lebanese culture, Middle Eastern culture, Arabic culture, global culture. And so the work of Rabi Alameddine teaches me about how to understand a world that I don't know firsthand, which is one of the things I think that fiction does. His latest book is The Angel of History, a look at one mind's battle with its own demons and saints, memories and desire for nothingness. Now, one of the things that interests me here, and I am aware that I'm about to walk a fine line, this is not a novel of identity politics, although they play a role within the novel. This is a literary novel in which the characters are engaged, in particular the central character, are engaged in exposing the vulnerabilities of identity. But I'd say that it's very important for you as a writer that the book be literary as well as, or even more than, political.
I don't know how to separate one from the other, but I can tell you that my goal and intentions have always been literary. I never see my work as political, even though it is definitely political, because I am a political person. I don't see, again, I was interested that a lot of people saw the book before that as political, even though it's about a woman living by herself in, you know, 3 days in her life, had nothing. But it is seen as political because it does have certain political stances. But I cannot imagine writing about life without writing about, you know, politics. It's part and parcel of it.
Yes, but I would say that you could also not imagine writing about politics without also writing about culture. So that in this book, immediately, the loss of the soul of the central character is a Faustian loss.
Yes.
And because we're dealing with Faust in a novel by Rabbi Alameddine, it's going to be every Faust. So the devil from The Master and Margarita, one of my favorite novels, a great Russian novel, is as much here as is his cat, Behemoth, and Behemoth plays a beautiful role. He tries to scratch with his sharp paws the auras of the saints, and he topples because the auras are made of light. I would say that the pleasures, the delights of this book are not just the heartbreaking truths about how we live without equality, but also the way literature elevates us and makes any one of us anyone's equal.
Yes, I mean, again, the thing is that, is it a book about, I love the fact that you brought up it's about identity politics. I never see it that way. It's a book about a person. I don't make a differentiation between the narrator of the last book, which was a 72-year-old blue-haired woman who lives by herself, and Jacob, who's a, you know, gay, dark-skinned poet living in San Francisco, who's, you know, a masochist. The thing that I find interesting is that the books are defined, are placed in different categories, because one is a sort of a queer subject and one is an Arab subject and one is... And I never understood that. I never understood the balkanization of literature.
Well, what's fascinating to me about the two books taken together is that the woman who has worked for many years in a bookstore celebrates each year by beginning, if she can, a new translation. These translations are not for anyone. They are the acts of her solitude. And similarly, in The Angel of History, as we go deeper into the book, we see that all of these dialogues are internalized by a man who is now carrying so many voices that he's trying to get himself committed to a lunatic asylum so he'll have 3 days rest with a lot of drugs and sleep from the voices that are inhabiting him. It looks like a novel full of characters.
It is. It is.
But they're all internal, and Satan inhabits the narrator's ear. He says very funny things. Sometimes he quotes from Cole Porter songs. Mm-hmm. Because the young poet is so subservient, Satan sings, "Baby, if you're the bottom, I'm the top." There's no end to the occasions for frivolity, because the nature of the argument is taking place within the self, and he's good at making fun of himself.
And this is a central argument. The book is about the AIDS epidemic, and it's about, but the book is about a soul and how we fight for how we fight to live. Is it about, you know, how much we remember and how much to forget? And it's a constant struggle. And what I was hoping to accomplish with this book was an attempt to show that the way we live now is a little bit too much onto one side, which is that we forget a lot. And what Satan does is in his own way, try to push not just for memory, but a push for being alive. It's that the soul needs not just to remember, but needs to accept a certain amount of suffering so that we are actually alive.
It's a wonderful book. I recommend it highly. You know, a world in which we're lucky enough to have a writer like Rabih Alameddine is a world also in which you mustn't neglect him. It's very easy to read a less fantastical, a less amazing, a less demanding book. But instead of reading an easier one, read this one, The Angel of History, published by Grove, by my guest, Rabih Alameddine. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Angel of History at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, and Patrick Ness is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.